Can I ask everybody's attention? Let me introduce our first keynote for the seminar. Fred Derving, who is a professor of multicultural education at the University of Helsinki. Professor Derving specializes in intercultural communication education, the sociology of multiculturalism and international mobilities in education, exploring the politics of interculturality within and beyond the canon of intercultural communication education research, has been one of Derving's idéfixes in his work over the past 20 years. He has published over 160 articles and 80 books in different languages on identity, interculturality, mobility, migration. His latest books include, but not limited, include The Paradoxes of Interculturality and Intercultural Communication Education and Research. And there's many more and many more in making. Warm welcome, Fred. And before I give Fred a floor, I will also introduce our commenter for Fred's talk, Amigeng Alemanchi Atapong from Åbo Akademi. He is a head of the English medium program, social exclusion program in Åbo Akademi Turku campus. And Amin is also a pioneer of the anti-racism education in Finland, but also globally. And we are very happy to have both of you here this morning. Fred, floor for the
Okay.
screen is yours.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you, Heidi, for having me this morning with you. And thank you to Amin for commenting on what I'm going to say. I have quite a lot to say. I'll try to stick to the 30 minutes that were allocated to me. So my name is Professor Fred Derving, and I'm from the Faculty of Educational Sciences at the University of Helsinki. And this is what I'm going to talk about. This is taken from one of my latest books, published by Cambridge University Press a few months ago. And the title of my talk is Critical and Reflexive Interculturality in Teacher Education and Training, One Way Forward. And I do insist, one way forward, meaning there are many, many ways forward, but I'm just going to share some of my ideas. Now, looking at 2023, autumn 2023, and since 2020, although all of this started well before, many people might be tempted to call what we are experiencing as clashes of civilizations or a clash of civilizations in reference to Huntington's work. Obviously, what we have seen since 2020 and before is that it's not actually a clash of civilizations that we have been facing, but it's more like different clashes of politics, competition for global influence, geopolitical ambitions, divisions, or to refer to Fraser's last book, cannibalistic capitalism. And got a long list of things that are not so nice that I don't need to read. We're pretty aware of this, of these. And I'm here to talk about interculturality. You know, when I wake up every morning, my days are very boring. I write, I do seminars, but I do nothing else. But I must say that for the past 2 months, waking up every morning and having to write about interculturality when I see the world dissolving and being in the situation that it is now, I really ask myself a lot of questions about this key term that I've been using for nearly 25 years, interculturality. And I find all this to be very depressing, but we're going to try to be as optimistic as we can, engaging with this notion of interculturality. These are just three books that were published in recent years, books that relate to teacher education and training. And the one in the middle is the main inspiration for this book. And of course, it's continuation of all the work that I've been doing over the years about teacher education and training using Finland as a platform for developing my ideas, but also internationalization and so on and so forth. The first questions that I ask myself about this idea of interculturality is how relevant it is still for today's teacher education training. And what I would want to share with you is how to feel a bit empowered to prepare future teachers for the world to come in relation to this issue of interculturality. Of course, the first challenge that we face when we talk about interculturality is that it's one of the tens, see hundreds of terms that are used in the English language, English as a global language, but also in other languages to refer to something that has to do with diversity. I'll use this term at this stage, and I don't need to go through all of these. And then when you start checking this very word intercultural, but also multicultural, transcultural, cross-cultural in different languages, even in Englishes, you realize that sometimes they are not even used, or at other times, they have a completely different meaning. And usually these are some of the questions I get asked about my work. And although these are legitimate questions, I find them to be extremely problematic these days to answer. What is interculturality, Fred? Why don't you call it, meaning interculturality, interculturation in English? Why don't you shift your thinking towards transcultural? One of my favorite questions usually gets me pretty annoyed. And what is the difference between multicultural and intercultural education? These are very, as I said, legitimate questions, but I don't think they are the right questions for 2023. And my usual answers are this. Well, it depends. Each of these terms are polysemic. Not one perspective is better than others, especially because they are polysemic in English, in other languages, and in different fields of research. And of course, contextual, economic, political, and linguistic aspects always influence what we do with these terms. And I often use this slide. My interculturality is not necessarily your interculturality. And here, mine doesn't mean my, but means everybody's interculturality somehow. But I'm sticking to the term. I could have shifted. I mean, I'm a professor of multicultural education. I could shift to transcultural, I could shift to cross-cultural, just name it. But it's not about the term, it's about what we do with the terms, actually. And my interests are mostly about problematizing the complexities of the inter and the ET of teacher communication education, and to reflect on what could the inter mean and entail for different people, where and why. And so today, this is what I'm here for in the few minutes that are left. I want to share some ideas about what to do with the notion of interculturality in teacher education and training, but I'm not going to tell you what I think it is, this notion, or what it should be, and how we should do it as educators working with others, between inverted commas. If you want more about this, go back to my very old book from 2016, which I have recently rejected in terms of content for its highly ideological and Western content. What I want to do is more to discuss the importance of being curious about the polysemy of this notion and the different applications that it's been witnessing around the world in different corners of the world, to enrich our takes as teacher educators, researchers, educators, and so on and so forth. And for me, this is for the benefit of students. You know, in my writing, in my research these days, this is the person I think the most about. I'm not interested in, you know, what we researchers are trying to say, or I'm not interested in just talking to teacher educators. But by the end of the day, what we do with interculturality should go back to the students. And of course, being a teacher, this on my slides, there's too much text. I apologize, but I'll summarize some of it. I'm too tired these days to make good. Well, I think I've never made good PPTs, but this is probably one of the worst one you'll witness from me. Of course, it's so obvious that being a teacher, it involves all kinds of tasks and responsibilities. And being a teacher is a very intercultural job. It's intercultural in the sense that our classrooms and the different contexts that we have to encounter as teachers are always diverse and involve interculturality one way or another. Inside the classroom, working and socializing with students, engaging ourselves and students with knowledge interculturally, etc., and of course outside the school, because our work doesn't stop, once we leave the classroom. And so engaging and mediating with parents and our contacts with the media and so on and so forth. Recently, for 3 years, I have made a distinction, a very important distinction between interculturality as an object of research and education, the way we conceptualize it and what we make of it, and interculturality as a personal endeavor for meeting other people. And my presentation and my work these days is more about interculturality as an object of research and education rather than as a practice or as a concrete phenomenon, outside the sphere of education and research. I think that discussions around what we speak about, what we do in research and education, deserves to be looked into much more, because it has, by the end of the day, has an impact on how we practice, and especially the people that we teach practice interculturality. Of course, as a notion, as an object of research and education, it's no mystery to note, and this is what our colleagues did in just before the pandemic, that the field is dominated, the broad field of intercultural education, teacher education, etc., is still very much dominated by people from very limited corners of the world, like the US or the UK. These are the names of people whose research has been the most influential in relation to the concept of intercultural competence, which is very much used in teacher education as well. And they all share the same characteristics. They are white, they have English mostly as their first language, and they are located at prestigious universities based in the US and the UK. And then they also work for supranational institutions like the UNESCO or the Council of Europe, and spread their ideological takes on interculturality to the rest of the world. This is the situation. I don't see really any change in the near future about this, although we talk about decoloniality and so on and so forth. These are still very much dominating. And of course, that's a problem that teacher educators need to be aware of. Because interculturality can actually, of course, mean and entail different things in different languages, different contexts, and different ideological environments, let's say. And it can be used very differently in teaching and learning. And of course, we always need to remember that the way it's used relates to specific economic political context. The way we use intercultural in some Finnish universities, not all the same, but there might be some similarities. And the way the notion is used in the Philippines in the Tagalog language, does not necessarily, because of the different context, economic, political, the way the notion is understood and done is different. And also in different contexts, although we say interculturality, I'm not going to spend time on this, I've been writing about this for a long time, but for me, it's not about culture. I don't know, and I will never really know what this culture word actually refers to in 2023. And you can ask me questions about this later. But we need to be aware that in many contexts, people might use the term intercultural in English, English is English as a lingua franca or other languages, but refer to other constructed realities such as race, ethnicity, migrant background, religion, indigeneity, language, or even a combination of all these and social class. So I stick to interculturality, being very much aware that this culture thing in the middle can be completely misused and understood in so many different ways around the world. And there have been different approaches that some form of intercultural education in different parts of the world that are not so well known, but that can contribute to enrich our takes on the notions such as Ubuntu in some parts of the African continent, interculturalidad in South America, Dowa education in Japan, and so on and so forth. Here again, I've written extensively on this. If you want to know more, I'm happy to discuss a bit during the question time. So if it's not the same as a notion between us specialists and educators, how about between us and others in school and beyond? Which leads me to the question, who can decide what this interculturality should be about and how we should do it? Of course, there's no simple answers to this, because there's, but and it's an endless issue, right? Because the more I dig in different epistemic contexts, epistemic ways of thinking about, you know, diversity and how we live together, et cetera, et cetera, the more doors I open, and it's a never-ending story. But I think that for teachers, for the future of teacher education, there is in fact a need to continue thinking about the notion and to move forward together, complexifying it and multiplying the voices addressing the issues that we face. I know that teacher education and education in most contexts, of course, they are highly political and they will follow curricula and what a selected few who have the power to decide how we talk and what we're going to be doing with diversity will, you know, will guide us. But we need to expand beyond the curriculum, beyond what these privileged people tell us what it should be about. And I think that as a white European teacher educator myself, of course, I have had the privilege to impose certain views on what interculturality should be for teachers. And that's something, so my 2016 book that I mentioned before, it's all about this. And I don't know if I was being ironic at the time, but the last section is even called the 10 Commandments for Intercultural Education. I mean, it takes some kind of biblical thing. What was I thinking? In my writing today, I'm not trying to impose anything. I'm only asking questions and providing answers, which I change as I move along in my exploration of the diversities of takes on interculturality. Now, in this book, which was published this year, it's a short book, but what I tried to do is I wanted to tell the world about what is it that I have learned from teaching about this as a teacher educator and a researcher in the Finnish context, working in teacher education. So it's quite a straightforward book. You know, there's an introduction where I justify the need for this book, define and minimize some of the terms like criticality and reflexivity, and then propose an extensive literature review of research that's been done in this in different parts of the world, but of course, noticing that this is highly dominated by so-called Western ideological takes on interculturality and other similar terms like multicultural, transcultural, etc. But what I do in the third part of the book is that I propose some kind of critical and reflective tools for future teachers and teacher educators to rethink and think, rethink and think, rethink without stopping this notion of interculturality. And these are the objectives that I set in the book for teacher education and training. Number one, we need to refuse single ideological entry points into interculturality as teachers. We need to think beyond the box. Everything is political about the way we talk about the intercultural in research and education. We need to be aware of it. We need to weigh the pros and the cons, but we need to expand. We need to be curious about how the rest of the world actually sees something like intercultural. The second point is to reflect on what we can do with what I call the bric-a-brac, the mix, the melange of terminologies and ideologies about interculturality from the international, but also the local literature. So if we can read in different languages, or if we have access to translations, be curious about other ways of defining, dealing, and categorizing things as intercultural. The third point is learning how to take into account contextual and linguistic discussions of interculturality. Something that really surprises me, and you know, I'm like thinking back, reflecting back on my previous work, is how little language matters in the way we discuss interculturality in teacher education. So if we publish in English, if we publish in Finnish, if we publish in whatever language, we will tend not to try to unpack both the meanings, the definitions, and the connotations of the words that we use to talk about interculturality. And that is, of course, very problematic because, of course, we have kids and students and colleagues from all over the world working with us now. No one is immune, I take a bad word here, but immune against interculturality. It's here, it's in us. So, and a lot of it, most of it, is taking place through different languages. And taking a word for granted, like tolerance in the English language, or you know, I put a lot of example in this book, as if it meant the same for the whole world, as if it meant the, you know, the same values and same actions and practices were attached to it. That's not, well, number one, it's not intercultural at all. And number two, that can lead to a lot of problems in trying to implement some form of interculturality in education. The fourth one, to learn to make informed choices about the way we problematize, discuss, and put interculturality into practice in our teaching and research. Over the past years, you know, having interviewed a lot of students from different parts of the world, student teachers, international students, and specialists of different fields, what I have noticed with my team is that so many of them have been indoctrinated to speak about interculturality in ways that they, number one, don't necessarily understand. Number two, don't even criticize. So they take things for granted. They repeat somehow slogans that they've learned through courses or their reading or whatever, whatever. I remember one student, you know, who defined interculturality, a Chinese student, you know, using Michael Barham's model of intercultural competence. And that's okay. I'm not a big fan of this model, but of course it's, you know, it's done a lot of good and bad at the same time to our field. And when I asked the student, like, number one, how do you understand all these terms that the author is using, like, you know, tolerance, citizenship, etc.? Well, he was unable to answer this question. And then I said, how does this compare to your own international experiences? Because the student has. And he said, well, actually, because I don't really understand the model, I don't know how it compares. And then we started talking about his own experiences. And I noticed that he was able independently to speak and problematize this experience without, you know, using these models that are, you know, we are fed with somehow around the world from certain parts of the Western world. And I find this to be very problematic because I somehow, when I was talking to many students, I felt that I was talking to, you know, when I was talking to one student, I felt a bit schizophrenic because they were rehearsing, reciting, you know, blah, 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 the official text and the official, research that had been supported by their supervisors. But then when they started talking about their own experience, it was such a gap. And I felt them, I heard their voice when they were talking about what they had done with the others while when they were talking about these models. Yeah. So here the idea of informed choices. I would really want, you know, student teachers and teachers in the future to be more in control of how they want to understand interculturality, how they want to do with it, and how they want to change these understandings and ways of doing it somehow. And the last objective is to build up systematic curiosity for diverse takes on interculturality to enrich our own thinking and actions in the classroom and beyond. Curiosity. Even if we don't understand the language, we have all these ChatGPTs, whatever things that can translate for us. I mean, I'm really, that's me actually. In the past, I was so Eurocentric, so brainwashed by myself and the system and whoever I can blame for this. Staying in this sort of doxa, this sort of voice that repeats but doesn't reflect and doesn't give a space to other ways of thinking about this notion. Of course, my experience in different parts of the world, working with different researchers, you know, taking the time to listen, taking the time to argue, taking the time to translate things to try to understand, has really triggered this systematic curiosity. And once you open this gate, I mean, it's more than a life, endeavor somehow to learn more about this. I think time-wise, I'm probably in trouble now. Let me just check. I should conclude soon. So I'll skip some of this. This is in the book, but what I do in the book in the last section, so the third chapter, is that I use four conceptual metaphors to try to make sense of, I can't see the word there, make sense of and use of interculturality in teacher education. The four metaphors are the three steel towers to reflect on what we think or what we've been thinking about now, what we understand from what we think and what we agree and disagree from what we think. And then the other metaphor, sorry, I that would take too much time to get into them, but you can look into the book. And this is a representation of the four metaphors that I'm using. The language kaleidoscope, which is the last one, is something that I've rarely seen in teacher education. And the language kaleidoscope, I can get to this just a little bit. I think you all know what a kaleidoscope is. So basically, you know, you look through and you have all these pieces of different colors that create, like a multifaceted, colorful realities somehow. And because it's only through and with language that we can discuss and make sense of an object like interculturality, and through direct or indirect interaction with other people that we do, language has to be central. And it's never an easy business because we have to construct thoughts and ideas. We have to negotiate meanings, etc., together. And sometimes, if we don't take the language aspect into account, I think that we treat terms like automaton in some kind of mechanical way that doesn't allow us to think further and to have like more reflexive impact on the students, for example. I'm thinking about these terms in Finnish and in English, social justice, culturally diverse, that terms I see everywhere. I've used them myself as well. And I'm very confused at the moment about what they mean or why we are using them, for example, in the Finnish context. Translation, of course, is very important here because whatever, you know, whatever we say, working on interculturality is always international. It's always multilingual. And of course, we don't know all languages, but we need to be very careful about the way we translate. We need to problematize translation. And I've added here two quotes from two people who've inspired me very much. Karl Kraus from the early 20th century, who said, "The closer the look one takes at a word, the greater the distance from which it looks back." And I think it's a nice way of thinking about, you know, this language. We look at these words, we think we know what we mean, but actually the more we look at them, the further away they get from us. And that's a very good sign. It means that we are looking at interculturality from a more complex, more there is no just one answer perspective. And then Lahiri, in I think that's the book she wrote about her experience of writing from English. I mean, she wrote in English first. She's from India, but she first moved to the US, wrote in English, became famous, and then moved to Italy and started writing in Italian as she was learning the language. And she's written quite an interesting book about this. And in this book, she says, translations goes under the skin and shocks the system. And I love this idea of shocking the system, because if we don't pay attention to words, if we rehearse the same terms, the same concepts without thinking, there's no shock happening. And although we need to be careful about this idea of shock, I think that being shaken in the way we think about interculturality is central somehow to teacher education and interculturality. This is the last slide. I'm sorry, I had to skip so many, but I was too ambitious as always. Until next time, I didn't put conclusion. Until next time, at this stage, interculturality, I would say, urges us to fight against our fear of change and to jump in and out of ideas, identities, and ideologies, leaving space for comfort, discomfort, joy, and anxiety, but also contradictions and some degree of coherence, incoherence. And there's a link here to what Heidi was talking about before me, and some of the participants, some of their questions, very clearly I could hear that there was a link to this. And so critical and reflexive interculturality for teacher education, for me, is about this. It's not about giving a ready-made answer as to what is interculturality, what to do about it, how to make it perfect, et cetera, et cetera. But it's more about asking questions and being curious about the different ways this notion and our relation to diversities in education has been. And I'll stop here. Apologies if I took a little bit too much time. And I look forward to listening to Amin's comments.
Thank you so much, Fred. And now I give the microphone to Amin.
Hello, Fred. Hello, everyone. Thank you, Heidi, for the invitation to comment on Fred's keynote. Heidi, Fred, and I think it's been almost 9 years since we've been together, or a few years, I think almost 6 years that we've been together like this. And I am, like Heidi said, I'm a researcher of racism and anti-racism education in Finland. And my work on racism and racism was or is born out of interculturality. Fred used to be my supervisor. And during the first 2 years of my PhD, I was working on trying to understand the term interculturality myself. It was a very interesting process. And I spent 2 years trying to understand this concept. And I realized that I could work on racism and anti-racism, and Fred could work on interculturality, and we could still be working on the same thing. So my take on anti-racism is actually not different from what Fred is or has been doing on interculturality. So like Fred said, we all have to find our ways of working with interculturality. You can work with interculturality without necessarily using the term interculturality itself. And the title of Fred's keynote had the word critical. And I've been thinking about this word a lot, and I know that a lot of you have used this word, and a lot of us, we still use this word today. So what does it really mean to be critical? I came to this country 15 years ago as a master's student in the University of Oulu. And as a master's student, I wrote a master's thesis. I know some of you are master's students. So one of the things that happened a few years back was I was invited to give a talk on Africanness. And I went back to look at my master's thesis. And I was shocked by the things I wrote in my master's thesis. And for example, today I called my master's thesis my thesis of shame, because in that thesis, I described my home country as poor. I said poverty was synonymous to where I come from, and everything about my country is poor. And I had a thesis supervisor who read my thesis critically and didn't advise me or didn't point out to me that maybe there was a problem in how I looked at the word poverty and how I described myself and how I described the country in which I come from. And when I look back, sometimes I want to blame myself, but I say, no, the blame is not necessarily all mine, because the job of my thesis supervisor was to help me at the time. And so I felt let down by my thesis supervisor. Today I supervise master's thesis as well. And I supervise thesis students from different countries, students from countries out of Finland. And one of my students from Nepal, a few years ago, when she came in, all she could say was, when I asked her to talk about Nepal, all she said was everything that did not work in Nepal. She complained about everything. And I said, but try to be critical about where you come, try to be more critical. And when I asked her to be critical, she went deeper into telling me how bad things from her home country was. So her idea of criticality was, to her, she had to what to be critical meant comparing Nepal to Finland and saying that this doesn't work because here things work. And I'm like, it reminded me about when I did my master's thesis. And I'm like, this is a chance for me to support this student. And I used 2 years and I tried to tell the student, just hang on, tell me five good things. One of the things I did was ask her, tell me five, write down five good things about your home country. And I said, you have 2 minutes, write it down. After 2 minutes, she couldn't write a word. And I'm like, take this as an assignment. So by the end of the master's degree, this student came up to me and wrote 15 good things about her country. Because I had taught her, or through being with me, she had learned that to be critical doesn't mean comparing what works and what doesn't work. To be critical doesn't mean you have to compare where you're coming from with where you are. Because these two countries, where you're coming from and where you are, have different histories. So I also encourage you all, both as students and as teachers, to think about how we teach about criticality, or how we are critical, how we situate ourselves in the word critical. Now, we have to remember, well, one of my friends, Andrew Candy, has a brilliant citing which I like to use. He says, the world can only be as equal, as fair, as just, as the knowledge upon which it's built. So we have to understand that as educators, we have to think about the knowledge that actually mold who we are, because we are a product of a particular knowledge system. And sometimes if you want to change the world, if you want to be critical, if you want to talk about fairness, justice, equality, we have to go back and ask ourselves, when we talk about these terms, we're talking about these terms based on what knowledge system? Because sometimes if we don't if we're not critical about our knowledge systems, we cannot do anything critically. And we have to understand, especially here in Finland, one of the things I learned about during my time in Finland is that very often when we are asked to be critical, we are asked to think along the lines of white supremacy. And I just told my students that I didn't learn about white supremacy when I came to Finland. I learned about white supremacy before I stepped foot in a plane to come to Finland. All my time, all my life growing up in Cameroon, I learned about white supremacy. And it has taken me time to unlearn white supremacy. And we need to be, we need to show empathy to our students when we teach them or when we discuss with them about critical or about terms like interculturality, terms like knowledge, and terms like change. Because to change the world, we have to go back to the knowledge system that upon which the knowledge system that has molded us. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, thank you both, Fred and Amin. And now I open the floor for the questions, both online and let's look online first, because I ignore it in my own opening words, but I cannot.
Okay, I can check the questions, yeah. If there's any questions online. Yeah.
So I can
out here. Rati asked if I can send my references, the references from the PPT. Yes, I'll put them on the platform.
Yeah. And then there is a comment from Fred to Amin that a very important argument. Amin, I have had many students from other countries, not including scholars from their context, because published in languages other than English. Yes, that's a very important. So now online, on site, participants, please.
When it comes to teaching interculturality or intercultural awareness, and I think like at the global scale, so we think maybe like schools or to teach it as a subject, do you think that it should go hand in hand with effective socio-emotional education to embrace this spirit of curiosity and nonviolent communication in intercultural environments?
Thank you. I think, if you have something to say about this, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Oh, you're too polite. Of course, dealing with emotions. But you see, my interest at the moment is more like at an epistemic level, right? And their emotions are also included, because you know, there's a lot of violence sometimes against certain researchers or certain voices today. And we need to think more carefully, right? So, for example, someone like Hofstede, who did a lot of work in the 1990s, you know, he has a big company and blah, blah, blah. Everybody's lashing at him. He died actually a few days after the pandemic started in 2020. And every time someone mentions Hofstede now, they just kill him, which is okay. But I think that we need to deal with it. We need to deal with our emotions. And for example, when I think about decoloniality, of course, there's a lot of anger. Of course, there's a lot of injustice. I mean, I've written several books with a very good friend of mine, Hamza Reboul, who is from Morocco. And we wrote together so much because I realized through him how privileged actually I have been, even if I've been critical of this kind of privilege. And, you know, the kind of emotions that I associate myself with my work as a teacher, education, or researcher, that's very different from the kind of emotions that Hamza or even Amin, I suppose, will have to deal with when you know, you realize that actually a lot of decoloniality stuff is just decoration, that people are getting into this just because they feel they have to get into this, but actually it's not serious. I mean, I read everyday articles about this, whereby the same voices, same privileged voices, I feel privileged somehow, although people are claiming to do this. So from this, you know, maybe more conceptual perspective, yeah, emotions is something that definitely, when I work with student teachers, it's something that we have to focus on. But the other aspects of emotion and work that you were mentioning, I'm not too sure about because I'm not too familiar with them. But I would assume that they are important as well. Hopefully.
Yeah, thank you for it. Yeah, just to add, the issue of emotion is very complex because there is emotion in almost every classroom. And there is no class, you can't have a classroom devoid of emotions. Now, the point is that at a certain point, certain groups of people with power and privilege can't use their emotions to override or shut out certain types of knowledge when things become uncomfortable. So how do you manage that? It's also a very critical question. It's also a very technical question. Because I cannot be silenced because somebody has white tears in my class. So how do you expect me to manage the situation? Because there are other students who also need that critical voice or that critical side. So issue of emotion is very complex, and there is just no one way to deal with it. I think we all have to be emotionally mature to deal with emotional issues. And that's one of the things we need to do. We need to have as teachers. Thanks.
There's comment and question online that from the University of Oulu. Thank you for your talks, Amin and Fred. Here at the University of Oulu, I am student member to the degree committee for the Intercultural Teacher Education Program, together with the Sister Master's Program, Education and Globalization. That's where Amin has graduated from, actually. We are one of the only programs in Finland that qualifies teachers that has a specific focus on intercultural competencies. During our 5 years, studies, intercultural education, social justice, and sustainability are at the epicenter of the majority of our courses. We often discuss with colleagues how it would benefit all student teachers to be exposed to these concepts. But after listening to your talk, it sounds like reflective intercultural thinking or systematic thinking for intercultural teaching and learning is crucial to prevent the inadequate of theories from perpetuating discrimination and misunderstanding. Is this the main recommendation for improving teacher education for intercultural environments?
That's a very good question, Anna. And actually, this is where the Finnish teacher education system has actually inspired me and transformed me somehow. Because if I look back pre-pandemic, my teaching for student teachers was mostly brainwashing, telling them what to think about interculturality, giving them somehow the only truth about this, and ignoring completely the realities, different realities in different corners of the world, and how these are spoken about in different languages, again, in different parts of the world, and especially ignoring the political and the economic, the influence of the political and the economic on discussions of interculturality in teacher education. So yes, for me, what teacher education can do for interculturality is not to brainwash, but to give the skills, or to not to give the skills, that's too pretentious, to promote the development of curiosity skills towards how this issue is dealt with, spoken about in different corners of the world. And then the teachers can do whatever they want in their classroom. It means that we are not telling them, don't use this word, don't say this, promote tolerance, blah, blah, blah. But together we analyze how this has been spoken about in our context in Finland and then in other parts of the world. And if we can create dialogues, for example, between our so-called local teacher, student teacher, and student teachers in other parts of the world, where they discuss how they position this kind of notion, it can create some really, really new ways of thinking about interculturality for future teachers.
Well said. Nothing else to add.
We have time for one more question.
If I may, oh, sorry. Again.
There's a question here. Yes.
I'm sorry to intervene again, but I'm eager to react to this. I like the word curiosity to assist students get open to other contexts, to open their minds to understand what others live, how they live their context. And this is an attitude of empathy, an attitude of generosity towards others, not thinking only about ourselves, but being generous, being charitable towards what we don't understand well, what we don't sometimes accept, but putting our shoes into other people's context and try to understand from their own perspectives. This can help us in collaboration to connect with them.
Yeah, that's very correct. And I think one of the things that we also have to understand in interculturality is the issue of power. That power is very central, and we don't hold the same power even in the classroom. So we have different powers, and sometimes we just ignore that and think that we're talking to we're dealing with people in a playing field. No, there are different power structures, and we need to be able to acknowledge these different power structures, and we need to be able to teach with and around these different power structures.
Yeah, very good point. I mean, I would add to this, and I go back to this, and you know, I'm old, so I repeat the same stuff all the time, but the language is, of course, the number one entry point into power. Because when a Chinese researcher and a researcher in you know, Cameroon or you know, wherever in the world, when they speak together in English about interculturality and they use words that maybe they don't realize are connoted in certain ways because of this Western, you know, hegemony, that's where we need to work, actually. And that's where we need to go via other languages so that we can try to renegotiate the meanings and connotations and maybe come up with new words. I'm doing a book at the moment where I've asked a certain number of people to invent new words to talk about interculturality, because we need a new language. And a new language, of course, it's still about power relation because someone will decide, but where we can promote at least some form of negotiation in the way we speak about this thing. So, yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Let's give applause to both Amin and Fred.